I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, everyone, and I hope you can all hear me as the recording gets underway for tonight's discussion on David Graeber's brilliant book about debt. My name's Gillian Tett. I'm a journalist with the Financial Times. And I owe personally a huge debt to David Graeber, no pun intended, partly because as a financial journalist, his wonderful book, which came out just after the financial crisis, really changed the way that I looked at the financial crisis and had a big influence on me and many others. But also because I was also, I'm also an anthropologist by training. And there was a time many years ago when people would ask me who were famous anthropologists. And I'd end up saying people like Margaret Mead, who lived almost a century ago. And then we had David Graeber, who not only made an incredible impact on the academic world, but also had a huge impact on discussions about politics at a particularly critical moment. It's absolutely tragic he couldn't be with us here today to join in this discussion, particularly at this moment in history when so much is now up for grabs in terms of how we talk about and imagine the political economy and the financial system. We could really benefit from his insight in so many ways. But we have a fantastic group of people to talk about his legacy, his contribution to debate at this important political moment. I won't waste a lot of time introducing them. Yanis Varoufakis, who former Greek finance minister and a towering intellect and activist on the European stage and beyond, who, of course, now is a Greek parliamentarian. Owen Jones, who is a well-known columnist who has done a lot to put ideas of the sort that David was championing into the British political discussion and mainstream. And Grace Blakely, who is another British columnist, again, who has had a big impact on the Labour Party and the left about how we discuss these very important political economy questions. And someone who actually knew David Graeber as well. And also knew Nika Dubrovsky, David's wife, who is with us today to join the discussion and is actually going to start this discussion by saying a few words, first of all, to frame the debate. So over to you, Nika, and then we'll have a discussion between us about the contribution that David made and why his ideas are so incredibly relevant today.
Thank you for inviting me. This is an important day for David, who should be here to celebrate it. He was looking forward to this day, proud of his book and dreaming that it would make the world a better place. First of all, 5,000 years of debt was a project to change the world by showing people the hidden power structures that control our society. And the original idea of making debt the center of the conversation belonged to Michael Hudson, an economist and historian of the ancient Middle East and David's friend. Debt abolition is a crucial concept developed by Michael Hudson, Steve Keen, David Graeber, and other activists, economists, and anthropologists in order to disrupt the institutionalized hierarchy in our society. I'm absolutely sure that we all want David to continue to be a danger to the current regime instead of becoming the celebrating mainstream after his death. So that's why I was intrigued by Thomas Piketty's introduction to the new edition of Death. It is a very favorable introduction, but I also know that David disagreed with Piketty about the role of Death in shaping the very power structures that control us all. David compared Piketty's proposal to stop the alarming growth of inequality with using a vacuum cleaner to reduce the force of an approaching hurricane. So personally, I would be incredibly interested to hear a debate on the origin meaning of debt and its relationship to the structural violence and emerging slavery. So last year, instead of funeral for David, we organized 250 carnivals run by David's friends worldwide, from Tokyo to St. Petersburg, from London to New York, from Paris to Rojava. And this September, we are going to celebrate David's life in the street of Madrid. And I would like to take this opportunity to invite all David's friends and comrades, and specifically Thomas Piketty, to participate in the debate about what is death, and to attend 1 year anniversary to celebrate David's life, hosted by David Graeber's Foundation and Museum of Care.
Thank you very much indeed, Nika. And I should say that one thing that's very fitting about this evening's discussion is that it's only the evening for the people in Britain. We have people watching from all over the world, where it's currently morning, nighttime, etc., etc. And that really is a testament to his incredible contribution and how it touched people from around the world, because debt is something which has not only been with us for 5,000 years, but is global, universal, and is implicated in power structures all around the world. So I'd like to start by asking perhaps Yanis, first of all, speaking as someone who actually has a proper day job rather than just writing, which is what the other three of us do, but is actually trying to run things as well, has been, how did David's comments or thoughts about debt and its implications in the power structures influence you when you were grappling with the very immediate challenges of the Eurozone debt crisis? And how do you assess his legacy? I can see a cat's coming to join us as well from the Owen side. Face it, Yanis, you can't compete with the cat. How do you see his influence and why was he so influential?
Gillian, let me give you an example. In 2015, when I was in the finance ministry of the most bankrupt European country, maybe the most bankrupt country, negotiating with the troika of creditors, as you know well, I remember Amartya Sen, the great Indian-British economist, saying to me, you know what your problem with you, Yanis, is? The problem you're facing, your tragedy, and that's the word he used, is that you're negotiating with creditors who do not really want their money back. And to understand what Amartya Sen meant, you had to have read Debt, David Graeber's book, because that was the whole point. You know, the worst thing that could have happened to our creditors at that very moment in 2015, just imagine for a moment that we were to discover hidden somewhere a treasure here in Greece, you know, some huge diamond underground, and we were to dig it up and send it to Amsterdam, have it all done up properly, and sell it for 350 billion euros and repay our debt. That would be a catastrophe for our creditors. They didn't care about getting their money back because, to begin with, it wasn't their money. It was the money of their taxpayers. For them, the permanent indebtedness and bankruptcy of Greece was a means by which to ensure that Greek governments did as they were told. So you will remember that in Debt and also in the podcast, which is a very good podcast by the BBC Radio 4 people, David tells a story of the opening sequence, one of the opening scenes in The Godfather, in which during the that famous scene of the wedding of the Godfather's daughter, one of the people that he patronizes comes to him and offers him money, offers the Godfather money. To either murder or, see to it that the man who raped his daughter was severely damaged And the godfather was very incensed. He said, I don't want money. I want you to be in my debt, because debt is power. And so on the one hand, there is this, which is extremely useful when you're negotiating with creditors who don't want their money back because they won't have power over you. But may also add the academic aspect of it, which is hugely significant. In a sense, as you know, Gillian, monetary economics has a creation myth. And the creation myth is that humans bartered with one another before money came into being. This is Adam Smith's famous expression to track barter and exchange, that this is part of human nature, which it is not. And David has demonstrated that very, very well, that barter did not beget money. Instead, people started trading, exchanging, having obligations. Of course, these obligations become debt. They're debt obligations. These debt obligations start to become tradable. And those tradable debt obligations, sounds like a CDO, but it's not that what I meant. These tradable debt obligations become money. And that is utterly intertwined with the authority of the government, of the lord, of the baron, of the witch doctor, whoever happens to be in the tribe. This capacity of David Graeber to connect the history of everything, the history of everything social and human, with, you know, moments of truth for the finance minister of a bankrupt country, with, you know, academic monetary economics. You know, it's a unique book. I don't know of any other book that has managed to appeal at so many different levels and to contribute to the capacity of so many different classes of people to understand and act upon our world.
Well, that is very, very powerful. So that's a macro picture in terms of looking at countries as a whole. Owen, you've been looking a lot more at what sort of this means for communities in the UK and, you know, the broader question about the working class and the power structures in relation to that. How has David's work been influential in terms of your political campaigns, manifesto, arguments?
Well, first, a big honour to be here to remember David. And I should also say, I can see I've appeared as Mr. Owen P. Jones, and that, for those who think that's just bizarre and inexplicable, I realised autofill, when you're typing in your debit card details, it comes up with your name on your card and it's entered that for there. That's why, just to explain, in case people thought I'd become some bizarre egomaniac.
Everywhere.
Exactly. It's my credit card. Yeah, indeed. Debt. I think for me, I mean, what was so, you know, in terms of my interest, particularly in class and class antagonism, I mean, David obviously had this key role in the Occupy movement and helped, it was instrumental in the popularization of We Are the 99%. And I think what was so important about that was for those, a younger generation who were raised in the age of the end of history, there is no alternative, where class conflict was seen to be something which was buried along with the, you know, was in the graveyard of statues of Marx and Lenin in the old Soviet bloc, that the defeats of the labor movement in Britain and elsewhere meant to speak about class meant, you know, go back to the 1960s, you dinosaur kind of thing. He reconceptualized class and helped to, you know, popularize class in a way people could understand and relate. There was always an argument about, you know, how accurate is the 99%? Lots of privileged layers are in the 99%, you could argue. And equally, such as the concentration of wealth and power, that the top 0.01%, you know, there's even more of a concentration of wealth and power there. But what it did is popularize a sense of not just how wealth and power is concentrated, but how it's accompanied by the machine of the state to protect it. And for those who were involved in many of the protest movements since 2011, Occupy onwards, who came face to face with being kettled and police batons, that very much, I think, captured their imagination. You know, debt as well obviously looms so large in this era for a whole new generation. But in terms of understanding class, I mean, we go back to the 1970s, the liberalization of cheap credit was used to compensate for the defeats, the routs of the trade union movement, which produced stagnating living standards. Very striking that the real average male wage in the US at the start of 1973 was higher than it was by the middle of 2018. And that was obviously, you know, if we look at here in Britain, the longest fall in wages we've suffered over the last decade since the defeat of Napoleon. Before the financial crash, for the top, for the bottom half of British society, wages were stagnating. And for the bottom third, they were actually declining. That was under a Labour government before the financial crash. So personal debt, you know, the personal debt was used conveniently to, and there's Keir, to justify, that's okay, Keir, that's Keir named after Keir Hardie. I always need to clarify that now. So I think that the personal indebtedness and the way it was used to compensate for the defeats of the trade union movement, the stagnating living standards, because they were so much intertwined. For a new generation, obviously debt looms so large, not least because you are punished with debt for daring to dream for a university education from which all of society benefits. For an English student, the average debt now is £40,000 in the United States, over £30,000, $30,000, sorry, where you often get these younger workers who have student debt and then end up in precarious jobs, zero-hour contracts and so on, and end up in further personal debt. And we know the impact on people's everyday lives in British society. 86%, according to one poll in Britain, said debt impacted their mental health. You know, those saddled with a bad credit rating. And I think this is what's so interesting about David Graeber reclaiming freedom from neoliberalism, which was used to popularize neoliberalism, the idea the individual is freed from the state and the dead weight of collectivism. You know, if you're saddled with a bad credit rating, people found their freedom restricted, difficult to find a place to live because they're rejected by private landlords, higher interest rates on credit cards and loans, higher insurance premiums. You can even be denied work. So I think what for me was so interesting is both how, you know, looking at the liberalisation of debt and how that collided with the defeat suffered by the trade union movements and the consequent decline or stagnation living standards, and how debt intersected, about how a younger generation were indebted because of those half who went to university or the precarious work. That, I think, you can't understand modern class formation under neoliberalism without that focus on debt. And it's so much part of the lived experience of a younger generation who were very inspired by David Graeber.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. And it brings me very well towards Grace, because Grace, I think you're talking to us from Hay, aren't you? Presumably where you're at the Literary Festival, probably to promote your own book recently, which came out last autumn, about the corona crash and how this is going to toss up many of these issues into centre stage all over again. So how do you see the current situation post-pandemic playing into these arguments that David Graeber put out about debt and power structures?
I think that David not being here during this particular moment in time is such a loss to our movement, because so many of the things that he was constantly highlighting are now coming to the fore. And, you know, on kind of relatively superficial terms, you can think about the changing nature of work and how much he wrote about that. You can think about debt and, you know, all the way in which the kind of the narratives of austerity and the morality of debt slips away at moments of capitalist crisis, only to be, you know, immediately rebuilt in the aftermath of those crises. But for me, I think the thing that David would be really emphasizing at the moment is, again, and, you know, I think I've kind of taken a lot of the work that I'm doing on this at the moment from David, is this idea that actually, you know, we are moving into an era of really authoritarian capitalism and authoritarian liberalism. And David would consistently have told us, contrary to the kind of laborist tendencies that he would have grated up against and pushed up against throughout most of his time organizing in the Labour Party, that, you know, Keynesianism isn't liberation from capitalism. Nationalization isn't even liberation from capitalism. And he was really invested in thinking about what liberation actually meant. In, you know, focusing on what it means to, as he puts it, act as though we are already free. And, you know, I think for me, that was everything about David. That was everything about him as a man, everything about his work. And I don't think we can really separate those two things out. He wasn't just this towering intellectual figure. I think he was someone, and this is always what comes back to me when I think about David, he was someone who was out there trying to teach us all what it means to be free, and how we all as individuals learn how to be free. If I think about David's work and the thread that kind of runs through everything that he's done, it reminds me of that Rousseau quote, which is the opening of the social contract: man is born free, yet everywhere he is in chains. David believed both of those things very, very deeply, that we are free, that we have the capacity to be free, that we can act as though we are free. And yet there are all these things that are weighing us down and holding us back. He was constantly asking, what is it that keeps man, woman, that keeps us in chains? And debt was one of those things. Work, again, was another one, which is why he focused on that later on. And, you know, that took him down a very interesting path of looking at the changing nature of class. One of the really fascinating threads that I think would have been brilliant to see him draw out was this idea of the revolt of the caring classes and what that means as we move into this kind of authoritarian capitalist nightmare, for hopefully not being too dystopian. But, you know, this this idea of debt as something that that weighs people down, that prevents them from not just kind of realizing a level of material freedom that will allow them to kind of, you know, do all the things that they need to do in life, but actually that constrains the way that we think. That is this powerful moralistic ideology that prevents us from even being able to imagine a world beyond capitalism, from even being able to imagine a world beyond neoliberalism. That is, I think, what the debt thing comes down to. It's not a question of saying that there is this inherent debtor-creditor relationship and that relationship is always characterized by the exploitation of the debtor by the creditor. I mean, David, you know, was far too intelligent to think that. You can look today at the way in which, you know, big tech companies are being able to borrow at very, very low interest rates, huge, huge sums of money, and then using that debt to go up and buy bonds in other parts of the, buy equities in other parts of the world economy, or the way that, you know, wealthy people are able to take out mortgages to buy a second home that they can then rent out to other people. The debtor-creditor relationship is not a class relationship. It's not something that's inherently characterized by exploitation, but it is mediated by class and actually highlights the importance of that labor capital relationship, or if you want to put it in more populist terms, that kind of 1%, 99% relationship. And I think that was really the thing that interested David, was the way in which debt, not just debtors and creditors, but actually debt for working people, kept them down, kept us down, keeps us from being able to imagine a world beyond the one that we're currently living in.
Well, I think one thing that's often forgotten in about David Graeber, because his book about debt was so popular and so successful, is he did write other fantastic books like Bullshit Jobs. And one of my favorite actually is about the bureaucracy, which doesn't get a lot of attention. But right now, particularly as we're all dealing with COVID pandemic bureaucratic nightmares, has become incredibly relevant to a lot of our lives. I'm going to actually go straight to the questions now to get the audience in. And I'm going to actually emphasize questions that throw this forward in terms of thinking about what David's ideas mean for our current situation. And I'm going to start off with a question from Julia Linares, who says that before David died, we were working on a project to democratize money and its institutions in the form of a universal basic income that is issued by people. What, in your opinion, needs to happen for the creation of such a money commons to come about? How would you decommodify money? Any of you got any thoughts about that? I can see Grace is smiling. Grace, have you thought about this at all? Or Yanis?
Yeah, this is something that David and I disagreed on slightly.
Okay, Grace.
I mean, yeah, David and I had a lot of really fun conversations about how we might unite post-Keynesian economic theorists and Marxist economic theorists. And if you were to pick an issue that you would be, you know, least able to unite these two schools on, it would absolutely be the question of money. So I'm not going to speak too much about the particular how I would understand what it would mean to kind of decommodify money, because it wouldn't align with a lot of what David would think about that. But when it comes to this question of universal basic income, the disagreement that David and I would have had on this was not one of substance. It was one of strategy and form. So for me, I was always much more in favor of this idea of kind of universal basic services, which would basically be that you would be removing the basically the kind of money relationship from that transaction that, you know, mediates the capacity of people to survive under capitalism. You know, you are, as someone who is born into a world where you have to sell your labor power to survive, forced to earn money in order to buy the things that you need to exist. And in engaging in the money economy, you are subject to exploitation, to alienation, to all these various different forms of oppression. And you come to think about your life, your value, the value of everything around you in monetary terms. The universal basic income, I think, for David, was a way of undercutting that. It was a way of saying, well, actually, if we give everyone money, then it loses this power that it holds over our lives. For me, I think an even more revolutionary thing to do would just be to kind of take money out of it entirely and to say everything that you need to live, all the things that, you know, the means of subsistence should be free to you at the point of use. So, you know, we should collectively own transport, you know, utilities, broadband. We should have a national food service, national care service, and all of these things. Everything you need to survive, everything that you need to feel free and to flourish as a human being would be available to you free at the point of use. But again, I'm talking about what I think now. I think I will open up to you guys to talk more about why David might have been, well, was so in favor of this as what I think is definitely like an exciting and interesting project and something that if it was to happen, I certainly wouldn't kind of get in the way of.
Owen, Yanis, do you have a view on UBI? And then Yanis, I'm going to ask you next about companies, democratization of companies. But Owen, Yanis, which of you wants to go first? Or the cat? We can ask the cat.
Owen, you go.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I find this debate about, I mean, you know, universal basic services is something certainly I'm very sympathetic to as well. I mean, it's you know, it's not even, you know, in Zurich, they've just made transport fees, which shows how it's a concept which is already emerging in practice in some various forms. I think the problem that people have with UBI was there were elements of the neoliberal right, like Milton Friedman, who pushed the idea of a negative income tax, which is essentially a form of UBI as a substitute or replacement for the welfare state. That was the danger as people saw it. I mean, there was the other problem with the universal basic income. I remember the Green Party had a bit of a mare, frankly, in the 2015 election in Britain for various reasons. But one was their proposals for universal basic income, when tested, and research was put into it, found it would actually leave poorer people worse off, which clearly was not the point of the scheme at all. But more recently, an academic called Stuart Lansley, who writes very extensively on issues of inequality, he actually put together a detailed report on universal basic income about how it could be phased in and made to work. And I think the point he was trying to make, which I'm very sympathetic to as well, is that sometimes the left, this has changed recently. I mean, I really do think we need to be clear that the left for a long time was very defensive and defined about what we were against rather than articulating coherent vision of the society we want to build. And that has changed clearly over the last few years, quite dramatically, I'd say, thanks to the brilliant work, including of two of the people, obviously, who are on this panel. But Stuart Lansley makes the argument that actually on the welfare state, the left often is just simply arguing for a return to the welfare state as it existed before the cuts were implemented under David Cameron and George Osborne's Tories and their successors, rather than trying to imagine what a new welfare state could look like and how universal basic income could very much be a part of that. So I'm very sympathetic to call me a triangulator, to a hybrid where you could have universal basic services, whether it be broadband, housing, transport, those sorts of things, which are critical for citizens to be able to engage and be fully members, active citizens of the society in which they live, as well as providing them with an element of you know, a UBI that provides some form of freedom and insurance as a matter of birthright. The other issue, I know others worry from a trade union perspective that it badly interacts with how workers organise collectively to improve their pay within the workplace. I mean, I suppose my caveat there was a lot of trade unions originally opposed the minimum wage for similar reasons because they thought that interfered with collective bargaining. So there's a similar argument used against UBI. That's a long-winded way to say I'm very sympathetic towards it, as workers obviously have become far more precarious. Right. And as technology, the other point, I mean, look, I'm not the non-economist here, but traditionally new technology created more jobs than it destroyed. The personal computer destroyed lots of jobs, but created more jobs in their place. And the danger is, though I know people disagree on this or differ to the scale, that new technology will now destroy more jobs than it will create, and therefore universal basic income could play a very important role in that context.
Right. Well, Yanis, do you have any views on UBI? And there's also a question also for you, I'll go on to, I mean, do talk about UBI, but also Vince Roy would like to know what people think about your idea of democratic corporations where only workers own shares in the company and each is given only one share, one vote. Is that something that you think would be a good extension of David Graeber's ideas?
I think the two go hand in hand. And even if the questions were not put to me in tandem, I would respond by bringing these two together. See, we are on the same page with the audience and with one another. My point is that we cannot democratize money on its own. When we leave the structure of capitalism, of what I call techno-feudalism, because we're not living in capitalism anymore, in my estimation, we can't live the way things are and then democratize money. It's a bit like saying that if we change the way we are measuring income and national product, then suddenly we're going to have a green society. It won't happen that way. On this issue, I'm completely with David, by the way, Grace. I have to tell you this. But with one important caveat that may bring us closer together, and with Owen's concerns that, you know, Milton Friedman was in favor of UBI, I am totally against the idea of a UBI that is funded through taxation, because this is hugely divisive. If you go to a blue-collar worker in Doncaster or in the Midwest and you say to them that we're going to tax part of your salary, of your very hard-earned salary or wage, and we're going to give it to a layabout or to a rich person, you know, that's a recipe for dividing the working class and turning them against the idea. But imagine, and here I'm coming to the second part of the question, Gillian, that we are democratizing corporations at the same time. And there are two ways of doing it. One is a very sort of gradualist way. Imagine that we were to say to Google, to Amazon, to any large corporation operating in our country, that if you want to add license to operate in our country, you're going to have to give a certain amount of shares to a public equity fund. The dividends accumulate, and those are then divided amongst the population as a universal basic dividend. And the idea is that the larger the percentage of the shares that go into this public equity fund, the greater the returns to capital that end up with everyone. On the basis of what? On the basis that, especially with modern technologies, every time, you know, you search something on your Google search engine, you're contributing to the capital stock of Google. Every time you upload a post in Facebook, you're contributing to the capital stock of Facebook. But you're not receiving any dividends. So, you know, if you think that Facebook pays out 1% of its revenues to its workers, right? 99% is produced, in a sense, to a large extent, by users. And they're not getting anything. So that's one, the gradualist step. But imagine the following setup. One share, one member, one vote in corporations. You know, it sounds outrageous. But then so did, once upon a time, the idea of universal suffrage. The idea that one person, whether they own property, would read or write, would have the same vote and with the same weight as John Stuart Mill, was outrageous to people in the 19th century in Britain. Because if you do end up with corporations that are owned by the people who work in it on the basis of one share, one vote, then suddenly stock exchanges go away. Immediately, there's no point in the central bank, in the Bank of England, not, or the Fed or the European Central Bank, not giving every one of us a digital bank account. And adding to that account a UBD, a UBI, just creating the money, just printing it in the way that they printed $9 trillion since the beginning of the pandemic, yeah, and effectively doing what you said, Grace, David wanted, you know, giving people an outside option. Because the beauty of receiving money or receiving your dividend from society, a monetary dividend from society, is that you have alternatives. When you say yes to a contract that is being offered to you, you're saying yes by choice. You're not saying yes because you don't have a choice. And, you know, the greatest exploitation and the greatest lack of freedom comes from the fact that lots of people simply have no choice but to say yes, in which case this is not voluntary and it's not a free choice. So imagine if we had, you know, the ledger of the central bank, each one of us a row on this Excel, the central bank simply adds, you know, £1,000 to each one of us. And then every time you buy a cup of coffee for someone or a bicycle or, you know, services, or you buy a newspaper, you know, numbers migrate from one cell of the same Excel, which is kept with the central bank, to another. And you can adjust that. You have immediate effect on the money supply. One last point, if I may, because we need to move on to the next question. Look, as I'm speaking to you, I have this screen here in front of me, and I'm using Chrome, you know, the internet interface. And that I just saw that, and it reminded me of David. You see, David is everywhere. Now, why did Chrome remind me of David? Because of the first three letters of the word. Chrome comes from the Greek chroma, which means color. But David has also analyzed that this CHR are the beginnings etymologically of two words that are utterly linked. One is debt, and the other is money in Greek. Chreos and chrima. I felt I needed to say that because David was not only a brilliant concept person, but also he was an anthropologist. He was an etymologist, somebody who sought truth in language, in the way societies experience stuff. And finally, you know, what was really mind-boggling to me was that he confirmed a hunch I had. And the hunch I had was that money did not emerge the way that economists say it. But what he actually confirmed was that it never emerged, not once, not in one community anywhere in the world, in the way that the monetary economics textbooks tell us. And that is linked up to freedom from lack of options, UBD, as I call it, the universal basic dividend, which combines debt, state debt, with money, with a universal basic payment, with the democratization of corporations, with the end of stock exchanges, which in the end would really free up even markets. Markets would be a lot freer under that regime that is consistent with David Graeber's work.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. There's a lot of ideas there to unpack. But it dovetails into something else, another question that's come up from the audience a couple of times, which is to do with the role of digital currencies and how that changes these ideas. And I'm curious whether Grace or Owen have views on this. We have a question from Yuval asking, how do you propose non-state controlled currencies such as Bitcoin or NFTs change perceptions about what's money, property, and debt? Grace, you look overcome with emotion.
If David was here and he heard people talking about Bitcoin as something that was potentially kind of liberatory and emancipatory, he would not get angry at anyone, because he never got angry at everyone. He would politely ask people questions as to why they thought that this was something that was going to liberate us from capitalism. No, I mean, Bitcoin and the euphoria around Bitcoin has as much to do with the anxieties of a dying ideology, which is liberalism, and combined with the just insane kind of monetary system that we have at the moment, which is, you know, which is being subjected to a set of policies that is unprecedented in the history of capitalism, which is that central banks are using their powers to create huge amounts of money, which are being channeled into financial markets, which end up in the pockets of financiers. And those financiers are saying, what do we do with all this money? This then, you know, aligns with the pandemic situation, in the sense that a lot of Americans, a lot of people, you know, in various different wealthy countries in the world, suddenly find themselves with a lot of money. And the wealthy, the middle classes are all saying, what do we do with all this money? And Bitcoin came along at exactly the right time, because it is one of those things that is associated with a very powerful libertarian ideology, which says that, you know, the reason that we are unfree is because the state is controlling the medium of exchange, which is the thing that is supposed to allow us to kind of come face to face with one another in markets and truck and barter, as Yanis would have said, on free terms. And the state's controlling it, the state's debasing the currency. Take that away and you have a free form of capitalism. Now, for those of us who are Marxists, we would see that as an oxymoron. But, you know, even if you don't, the idea that somehow having a form of currency which isn't backed up by the state could, you know, create this kind of free form of capitalism is absurd, not just because there is no money without states, but all of the reasons that David outlined in the book. And, you know, if someone who asked the question hasn't read the book, please do go away and read it, because it will tell you everything you need to know about why Bitcoin is a fallacy. But it's also not a currency. I mean, it's an asset. It has a use, which is basically that it is broadly untraceable. So, you know, people who say it has no uses and therefore has no underlying value are wrong. You can use it to buy drugs on the dark web. And that is something that a lot of people do. So it does have a use, but it is not a currency. It's an asset. And the reason that it's gone up in value so much is because there's a huge amount of money flowing around the international financial system. It needs somewhere to go. It's going into Bitcoin. It's going into property. It's going into trainers. You know, these tokens that Nike's making, making NFTs associated with trainers so that people can trade their trainers without actually trading the physical trainer. So the crazy stuff we're seeing around Bitcoin is the culmination of two very weird trends, one of which is the decay of liberalism, which is kind of associated with this weird fringe libertarianism. And the other is mass asset purchases by central banks. And it is not something that is going to free anyone. It is, if anything, going to mean that you're going to lose a lot of money. As one reply to Elon Musk that I saw the other day saying, you told me to invest in Dogecoin and I lost £150,000. What the hell, man? So that would be my view.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Okay, well, Owen, what I'd like to do is, unless you've got a strong view about Bitcoin, I'd like to throw another question, because we got so many brilliant questions. And this one, I think, is really good for you, because Christoph Majewski says, here in North America, which is where I normally live, just happen to be in the UK right now, a preoccupation with identity politics frequently dominates the conversation on the left. If David Graeber were here today, what advice would he have how to deal with this? And really what the question here is, you know, is there a danger that the left in America, maybe the UK, has become so focused on identity politics, it's been at the expense of economic justice and other economic issues?
Well, I don't actually want to ventriloquize on behalf of David Graeber there, but what I'd say is I think there's this very problematic conceptualization of the working class, which is often very, very reactionary, which the new right have very much seized upon, which is often, frankly, to portray one segment of the working class, which is often retirees, pensioners, who often own their own homes, who are white, who are socially conservative, who may well hail from working class backgrounds originally. But if you, and I hate generational politics, it's very important I make that point. I mean, if you look in Britain, there are 1.9 million pensioners who live in poverty, which is a significantly higher rate than much of the industrialized nations. But you get, you know, this focus on that section, and there is a division. There's a generational division that has opened up without precedent. In 1983, Margaret Thatcher won a landslide, including amongst younger people. And in the 1980s, all younger people were the most likely to support Ronald Reagan. In 1968, the most pro-Vietnam War generation were the young, the most hostile were older Americans. So that generational divide that has opened up today, more younger people support Labour than ever before, or did in 2017 and 2019. And in the US, you saw Bernie Sanders win a decisive majority in primaries amongst younger people. What's happened there? Older people, as I've said, tend to own their own homes. Home ownership's gone up. Quantitative easing has pushed up their house prices. And they tend to be more socially conservative on issues like immigration, multiculturalism, Islam, feminism, LGBTQ rights. And younger people have suffered a terrible squeeze in their living standards. They're saddled with debt if they go to university, but also personal debt. They're in precarious work, and they tend to be socially progressive. Now, the point I say about the working class is, you know, an older person who's white and is socially conservative and straight is a valid part of the working class. But the working class is not just that. The working class includes people, as the working class has always been a diverse rainbow, it includes people born in a certain country or who originate from elsewhere. It includes a black supermarket worker in Hackney, and it includes a white retired steel worker in the Midlands. It includes someone who is gay or trans. It includes people who own their own homes or are private renters. It includes people, you know, this whole complexity of the working class is very important. And, the point I'll just quickly say is, we know this intersection is common sense. If you're working class, you suffer oppression, exploitation based on your class. But if you're a woman, you're more likely to be concentrated in the lowest paid and most precarious jobs and have to do unpaid labour disproportionately at home. If you're a gay worker, you might be on minimum wage in a supermarket, but you might also suffer homophobic intimidation when you walk down the street, or you can't even hold hands, you know, with your partner. You may suffer discrimination from, from landlords. If you're black, you're far more likely to be poor or unemployed. These are all issues which intersect with class. They can't be divorced from class. They can't be separated from class. The working class is a diverse rainbow and a diverse spectrum. And there is no, you know, the whole point of being on the left is to fight for the liberation of all from all forms of oppression, exploitation, bigotry and racism. That's what David Graeber consistently right. argued for. You can't strip away this idea of identity politics, which is just a means to say which minority you're going to throw under which bus. Based on some reductionist notion of the working class is offensive, anti-working class. And, everything I ever saw and heard from David Graeber very much did not have this one-dimensional view of a white working class, socially conservative, who spends their time, you know, obsessing with which minority to throw under which boss.
Well, that's well put. We have some questions. We could have another five-hour session, I think, just getting through them. Interestingly enough, a lot of them about the issue of UBI or variants of UBI, universal services and stuff. So that clearly is striking a chord. But there's another bunch of questions which are also talking about issues very much at the moment. But I'm going to pick up some of them, a different one. Maybe one for you, Yanis, from Greg Watson. What would David have felt about the changing post-COVID dynamics between China, the US and the EU? What advice would he have given to Joe Biden?
It's really very difficult for me to project from his books on debt and bullshit jobs to this. So allow me to assume that we would be on the same page, and I'll tell you what I think, if I may.
Yeah.
This is the best I can do. An economist, there are not that many economists that I hold in high regard today who are still alive, Gillian. But Michael Pettis, who teaches and works in China, is one of them. His recent book, Trade Wars Are Class Wars, is a classic. It deserves to be on the same shelf as debt. And I think that Michael Pettis has the answer to this particular question. And I do not want to bore everyone with a long-winded argument. But the great fallacy that those in authority in the United States and in Europe, especially in places like Germany and France today, they are peddling a fallacy. And the fallacy is that the working class of the West, of the North Atlantic West, has been effectively pushed into misery by the rising Chinese working class and the fact that China is squeezing its own labor in order to improve the lot of the Chinese working class vis-a-vis the West. This is not what is happening. What is happening is a simultaneous class war, both in China and in the United States or the West. In China, the class war takes the form of very high investment rates, a lot of money being created through the credit mechanisms, especially the shadow banking system, to propel huge rates of investment, which create a dynamic. But nevertheless, this dynamic is predicated upon a tiny percentage of the pie going to the working class in China. And the fact that it's, you know, Apple and American companies, corporations producing in China and exporting to the United States, when American public debt is being purchased by Chinese capitalists, creates the circumstances for the great squeeze of the wages of the American working class. So there are two working classes the Chinese and the American working classes who are consistently being shortchanged by their regimes, the Chinese regime and the American regime, the Western regime. I think that would come close to what David would have to say. So don't think of this as a trade war, as a Cold War, as a clash between China and America. This is an establishment in the United States and in China that is doing really very well by squeezing the living daylights, using debt also as an instrument of the working class, both in China and in the United States.
Can I very briefly come in on this, Gillian?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to climate next, but yeah, go on, Grace.
Sure. I just think there's one really clear lesson that we have here, which is that, you know, there is a tradition against which David was militantly opposed, which is to say that once you have state ownership over the commanding heights of the economy, then you will have a transition towards a different kind of system, one that will no longer be called capitalism. And the experience of China, which is the epitome of this kind of authoritarian, statist capitalist system, which is characterized by huge amounts of not just oppression and alienation, but exploitation of the kind that exists within capitalism, because it is still a system that is based around commodities production, shows that is not true. That actually today, as we move into this new world, this world characterized by high levels of state intervention in the economy, where the EU is looking to China and saying, right, well, maybe we should ease off on some of this competition regulation. Maybe we should try and have our own kind of, you know, big monopolistic corporations. Capitalism is not a system that is defined by the presence or absence of free markets. It is a system that's defined by the domination of labor by capital, of the domination of the many by the few. And that the route out of that is not just to have a state own all the stuff, it is to democratize every area of the economy and society.
Which is where digital technology becomes so potentially exciting, but also potentially scary. It can be used either way, and it sort of, you know, amps up everything in either direction potentially. Mm-hmm. But we haven't got a lot of time left, but I do want to come to one question again, sort of taking David's ideas and throwing them forward a bit, and say from Tanya Jones, very interesting question, maybe for you, Grace, first, which is, does the concept of climate debt bear any relation to debt as analysed by David Graeber? And is it the best word to represent that type of global moral obligation?
So I think what they're referring to now is the idea that there's a kind of debt relationship between generations, whereby, you know, the polluters and we today have a kind of debt towards those who come after us. Yeah, I mean, that is certainly true. Personally, I think there's another interesting way that you could use this, which is to think about this idea of the kind of carbon bubble, that the way that we run the economy today is premised upon the idea that we'll be able to continuously exploit the deposits of fossil fuels that we have today, and that economic growth will continue on the basis that we have it at the moment. And therefore, Exxon, Shell, all of these big corporations are valued on the basis that that is going to continue, whereas actually that's impossible. So there's a carbon bubble there, which you can think about as a kind of form of debt, in the sense that, there is this chain that needs to be broken for those assets, many of which are debt, to be revalued and to take into account the structural and environmental and economic trends that we're seeing take place today. But in terms of this kind of intergenerational debt, there is a way of thinking about this in moralistic terms, and it's a tempting way to think about it. David was a moral person. He was a person who thought a lot about morality. But I don't think he did the thing that a lot of people who analyze capitalism and say, oh, it's a bit bad, we should change X and Y and Z, do, which is to speak about change in moralistic terms, which is just to say, you know, capitalism is bad because it subverts these moral maxims that we have. He actually looked at many of those moral maxims, one of which is you always have to repay your debts, and said, these are socially constructed. And morality is socially constructed, and we need to kind of look beyond that. I think one of the things that David was always focused on, and the thing that he spent most of his life doing, was building power in our movements, in our classes, in our communities, bringing people together to understand the world in order to change it. And that is, I think, where we're going to get, if we get any movement on climate, that's where we'll get movement from. It's not by convincing people using moralistic language, you need to wear hair shirts and recycle and, you know, do X and Y and Z because you have this debt to your, you know, future children. It's actually, we as a community, as a society, as a planet, have responsibilities to one another, to ourselves. And by coming together, working together, talking our problems through, like figuring out a new way of understanding the world and fighting to build it, that's how things will change. And I don't want to ventriloquize again for David, but I think that's how he would have responded to that.
Well, I'm just curious, we're getting close to being out of time, but I'm curious, I'd like to chuck a question at Yanis, a very smart question from Anna, which reflects something, a theme that's come up in a lot of the conversations about the fact that due to COVID, the amount of money pumped into the economies means there's now incredible amounts of national debt. Another question that pointed out, we're now at record levels by a factor of several times compared to what we had pre-2008. Do you, Yanis, or either of you, Grace and Owen, have any hope that the sheer magnitude of debt that the world's now drowning in is going to spark enough of a crisis or enough of a realization about the need for a reset, a jubilee, a write-off, some form of proper debt forgiveness? Because, you know, it's not even happening in the low-income countries right now. But do any of you have any hope that the mountain of debt we're now facing, I mean, Yanis, you look at these figures a lot across the European Union, it's going to be big enough to force some kind of resolution. Are you optimistic?
No. Nope. Not in the slightest. They love it. Because the more debt there is, the more Italy is indebted, the more Greece is indebted, the more power the authorities have over the government in Italy, over the government in Greece. What they will do is not the jubilee unless we force them, unless we have a social movement, unless we elect governments that demand it. And they are prepared to act upon their demands. If that doesn't happen, what the system will do is will keep rolling over the debts. They will keep increasing, of course, because of compounded interest. And that will become even more of unequal power, as Grace said. The whole point about maintaining debt and not cutting it, even when it is unpayable, is to maintain this power. Remember, the European Union is not a federation. We do not have a political union. We cannot resolve issues on the basis of democracy. When prime ministers and presidents and finance ministers, you know, meet around the table, there is no serious discussion at all. There can't be, simply because there is no mechanism by which to make a decision that, for instance, the United States could make or the United Kingdom could make at the moment. For instance, you know, during the pandemic, the Bank of England was buying firsthand bonds issued by the Treasury. You know, the Europeans cannot do that. So instead, what they will do is they will keep rolling them over, refinancing, and using the enhanced power that the very few get from the burgeoning debt in order to decide who goes broke and who doesn't. Because insolvency, Gillian, it's a political issue. And this is another thing that comes out of the book of debt. It's a political decision. I mean, why are we not talking about, I mean, not me or maybe you, but why is Greece not in the first page of the Financial Times these days? We are more bankrupt than we were 5 years ago, far more bankrupt than we were five years ago. You know, our GDP has gone down, our debt has gone up, but we're not talking about it. Why? Because the powers that be decided that we're not bankrupt. They will keep rolling over our debt, as long as we do as they're told and, you know, keep, you know, foreclosing on people and selling their homes and giving them to vulture funds that go to take the money to Luxembourg. It's all about power. It's exactly as Grace said.
Well, sadly, it's also about time. And very, very sadly, we actually are bang out of time right now. But I think that's a very powerful note to end on and shows exactly why David's work is as relevant today as it was when he first wrote it. In some ways, frankly, it's even more relevant. I want to salute you, Yanis, for all you're doing to really try and put some of these ideas into practice. I'd like to salute both of you, both Owen and Grace, for all the powerful work you're doing writing and in your activism to try and put these points across. I should say that I'm personally delighted to have had a chance to chair this event tonight because about 18 months ago, I sat down and started writing a book about why I thought the world of finance, business and politics need to know a lot more about anthropology because I am trained as an anthropologist. I draw heavily in this book on David Graeber's work, not just the debt work, but also the bullshit jobs, which I think is actually in some ways one of his best books, and was very much looking forward when I finally finished most of the book last summer, very much looking forward to having a chance to talk to him, to show passages to him. I thought he probably wouldn't approve of parts of it because I do work at the Financial Times. But I wanted to exchange some ideas with him. Sadly, I never got the chance. But as Nika said earlier, there are going to be a series of events coming up where people will have a chance to really think about the ideas, exchange views, and celebrate what has been a truly fantastic contribution that, frankly, we should all honour. So thank you, all of you, for taking part. Thank you, Nika, for your very powerful words. And I think we should all go away now and reread Debt, the first 5,000 years, and hope it won't be Debt the next 5,000 years. So thank you all very much indeed.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.